When it comes to teaching kids and teens about money, practice makes perfect. That's where Greenlight comes in. With a debit card and money app of their own, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Parents send instant money transfers, create custom chores, and automate allowance, while kids track their spending, set savings goals, and practice money skills they can use today and for life. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
In the summer of 2004, the war in Iraq was raging. Fighting had intensified and evidence of American torture at the Abu Ghraib prison had just come to light. Democrats were promising a new direction for the war. And to make their case, they had just nominated a decorated war veteran to be their nominee, a man who had been awarded the Silver Star, the Bronze Star, and 3 Purple Hearts for valor in combat.
Thank you. I'm John Kerry, and I'm reporting for duty.
Senator John Kerry made his military service in Vietnam a central part of his campaign for president that year. In the weeks after he accepted the Democratic nomination, Kerry consistently led the incumbent, President George W. Bush, in the polls. But then in August, everything changed. That was when these campaign ads started airing.
I serve with John Kerry.
I serve with John Kerry.
John Kerry has not been honest about what happened in Vietnam.
He is lying about his record.
It's a central image of John Kerry's campaign. The candidate literally wrapping his arms around his Vietnam crewmates. But now Republicans are challenging Kerry's war record with a TV ad featuring other Vietnam veterans, none of whom served on Kerry's boat, claiming Kerry did not earn his medals.
They were the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth ads, and they were one of, if not the most impactful and most dishonest ad campaigns in presidential history. For weeks, the national news covered this story, comparing different accounts of John Kerry's war record. Eventually, it was revealed that the Swift Boat Veteran stories about Senator Kerry did not line up with the official record. But by that point, the damage had been done. The ads had aired across multiple swing states. President Bush opened up a wide lead in the polls, and Kerry's campaign never recovered. The phrase swift boating has since become a verb used to describe untrue and unfair political attacks. But the impact of that ad, the impact of that campaign went well beyond reelecting George Bush and broadening our political lexicon, because the people behind that campaign continued to test the boundaries of conservative politics and shape them for years to come. Among the top contributors to the Swift Boat campaign were people like the late Bob Perry, an instrumental figure, instrumental in turning America's evangelical movement into a conservative voting base. Also, Harlan Crow, the man who has been in the news recently for his lavish patronage of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, patronage that includes luxury vacations and private plane flights and questionable real estate purchases. Two of the central players in the Swift Boat affair were these men, John O'Neill and Jerome Corsi. They co-authored the book Unfit for Command. That would become the main source for many of the false or misleading accusations against Senator Kerry. Now, John O'Neill went on to become a director of one of the conservative movement's most prominent anti-Islam groups, the David Horowitz Freedom Center, which focuses on the efforts of the radical left and its Islamist allies to destroy American values. Jerome Corsi went on to become one of the leading proponents of the birther conspiracy, which baselessly claimed that Barack Obama was not born in the United States. He later became a bureau chief for Alex Jones's InfoWars. But of all the controversial conservatives involved in the Swift Boat smear, there is one man who is credited with being its mastermind. His name is Chris LaCivita. As New York Magazine puts it, it was LaCivita who turned O'Neill and Corsi's fringe allegations into a campaign funded by millions of dollars in shadowy contributions. And where is Chris LaCivita today? Where is he? Well, he's running pretty much everything. Chris LaCivita currently serves as Donald Trump's top political advisor. He has been described as the campaign's de facto campaign manager. La Civita was the brains behind the Trump campaign's efforts to smother Ron DeSantis' presidential campaign while it was still in its infancy. And now, in addition to his prominent role on that Trump campaign, Mr. La Civita has a new job, leading Trump's takeover of the Republican National Committee. According to the Washington Post, Trump's team, led by Civita, La Civita, is embarking on the political equivalent of shock and awe. The senior leadership at the RNC has been almost entirely replaced or reassigned, while dozens of lower-ranking officials, including state directors, were either fired or told to reapply for their jobs. The firings were done by La Civita. Among the people La Civita has hired as replacements is lawyer Christina Bobb. She's on the left there, a former reporter for the right-wing news channel OAN and an outspoken election denier. Christina Bobb will now be the Republican Party's senior counsel for election integrity. Election integrity being the right's preferred vehicle for engaging in voter intimidation and claims of voter fraud. So those are some of the changes that we know of at this moment. But what does it mean, really quite practically, that the guy behind the swift boat smears is now running another presidential campaign? New York Magazine suggests that Mr. La Civita's past, filled with trickery and lies, provides a template for how he will go after Joe Biden and the Democrats, not by attacking what is perceived as Biden's weaknesses, but his strengths. Joining me now is Michael Scherer, national political reporter for The Washington Post, who reported that story about Trump's takeover of the RNC. Also with me is former RNC chair and the co-host of The Weekend, of course, on MSNBC, Michael Steele. Gentlemen, it's great to have you here. Michael Steele, let me just first ask you about the appointment of Chris La Civita, famous for the Swift Boat campaign, and subsequent very intense, to be euphemistic about it, conservative campaigns. What do you think the practical effect that will be on the Trump campaign as we enter the general election?
It's less the practical effect on the Trump campaign, but the practical effect the Trump campaign has on everything else.
Right.
And it is the shock and awe. It is the idea of creating damage that will come in short bursts and longer bursts that cannot be contained. It is an asymmetrical political game, which I've been telling folks these guys have been playing for the last 6 or 7 years. And now it will come to fruition in this cycle because it all matters right now. It all has to work right now, because when they get the power back, that's how the rest of it's done. So, La Civita going to the RNC is a way to have him sort of straddle two universes, have his role in the campaign diminished, obviously, because of the requirements by law, but also having his ear and his hands on the till and the levers of power inside the Republican National Committee to make sure that the money, the structure, the infrastructure, the organization, and most essentially, which is what the firings were about, the personnel, are doing exactly what the design is. And that design, again, asymmetrical, means that you don't know that it's going to be the same tomorrow as it is today. And that's one of the strengths the swift voting showed, and what we've seen from Trump, particularly in this election cycle. This is not 2016, folks, and it's not even 2020. Trust me.
Yeah, I want to get back to that, but the the importance of what's happening at the RNC, Michael, which you reported on so helpfully today, is the bloodletting has been swift and it has been vicious, and it is effectively, it sounds like, Trump at all costs. I understand that from the perspective of Donald Trump and to some degree Chris La Civita, but what about the Republican Party? Not everybody has the last name Trump, and what are the implications here for other Republicans who are running this year?
I think there's two important things to know about Chris La Civita and the way Trump has been running his campaign so far this cycle. It is a far more competent campaign than we saw in either 2016 or 2020. It's top down. It's organized. They have a plan. They know what they're doing. There's not the personnel turnover we saw in both of the last cycles, at least so far. And they went through the primaries very smoothly. Chris with Susie Wiles has been a key part of that. The defining feature of Chris La Civita is He is a combatant. He wants to be in the fight, and he is fighting hard. And I think you've seen in the style of how he's taken over the RNC. Now, remember, it's normal for a nominee or presumptive nominee to take over the national party at this point. But Chris LaCivita this week went in and really cleared house in a dramatic way, made a lot of people in the building upset. There is concern, as you mentioned there, about down-ballot Republicans having the same benefits. I mean, one of the things he did is he's closing community centers in some communities and reassigning that money and that effort to be more focused on Trump. Now, LaCivita will say that Trump is at the top of the ticket. When Trump wins, Republicans will win up and down the ballot. That's the most important thing. I think what we don't know is how it's going to affect at the state level, and we'll see how the Senate and the House campaigns come along with these changes.
Yeah, I want to talk about that ending, early voting outreach. That seems like something you might not want to do, and yet it fits absolutely in line with what Republicans have been advocating under the sort of banner of Donald Trump for several years now. Michael, how much of an own goal is that? How much is that cutting off your nose to spite your face?
Well, we don't know exactly. It's all about...
Sorry, Michael Steele.
It's all of that. Put everything behind winning the presidency. Okay, so you're going to let governors hang out. What about governors in purple states? What about candidates in purple districts? How do they navigate a toxic candidate at the top of the ticket like Donald Trump, where you know that candidate is going to need Democratic and independent voters to support them? But now all the focus and emphasis is on Trump. So what do you think and who do you think those candidates are going to be talking about? So it is a strategy about one person, because that's how Donald Trump wants it to be. That's why his daughter-in-law is running the RNC. That's why LaCivita is running the RNC. That's why Whatley was picked to run the RNC. The other side of this scenario, folks, is that when Trump loses this election, all right, or if Trump loses this election, you're going to have this same narrative around stolen election, rigged election, all of that. And he'll have the bodies in place to prosecute that case better and more effectively from that point forward, which he did not have the last time because, people actually believe the constitutional oath they took and their responsibility to the country to uphold the election results. And that got in the way. Trump has largely cleared the way. And the cost will be to the RNC and to candidates running across the country in various state races and statewide races that are going to have to figure out how to find the resources and infrastructure they need to be successful. Because if it ain't about Trump, it certainly won't be about them.
Yeah. Michael Steele makes a great point, which is, you know, when you're talking about election integrity, that's I said earlier, that is about voter intimidation, but it is an insurance policy against a lost election, which is we can claim voter fraud. And now he has the ambassadors, if you will, in place, Christina Bob, chief among them, at the RNC. Can you give me a sense of what those election integrity efforts on a practical matter might entail and or the expectations that Christina Bob is going to be an effective general on that front?
I think Christina is going to be the front person on that front, and she'll be on TV a lot. She'll be speaking to the base. She'll be carrying the president's message, which, as we've known for 3 years now, is that any election that he's not performing well in is a fraud. I think there is a real effort here to do what a lot of Republicans feel the RNC did not do well in 2020. Up to the election day and then after the election day. Up to the election day, Republicans feel like they were just wiped out in questions of early voting, lots of changes about signature verification, changes about voter ID. They want to there's not much time left, but the RNC wants to go back in and re-litigate that stuff. There was actually a lawsuit filed today in Michigan in which the RNC is asking the state of Michigan to clear their voter rolls because they say there's too many old names on those voter rolls. And interestingly, they brought in Charlie Spies, who's another name we haven't mentioned here yet. He is, one of the most respected Republican election lawyers. He was the guy behind Jeb Bush's super PAC, the guy behind Ron DeSantis's campaign, the guy behind Mitt Romney's super PAC. And I think he's being brought in because they believe that he actually knows how to do this well. Whereas I think Christina Bopp, She's well known among the base. She's good on TV. I think she'll carry that message. But I don't think she's going to be the legal mind behind the scenes deciding how to prosecute this.
Yeah, I will leave everybody with a quote from this New York Magazine analysis here. In 2016, the Trump campaign was a totally shambolic operation. By 2020, you had a more professionalized operation, but it was effectively being led by Trump's web designer until the home stretch. And now we get to see what happens when you bring in some of the most shrewd, calculating, and ruthless operators in the party. An experiment on the national stage. Michael Scherer and Michael Steele, the two Michaels. Thank you for your time tonight, guys.
Thank you.
We have much more ahead this evening, including how are you going to learn the moves for Beyonce's Texas Hold'em dance if Congress actually bans TikTok, huh? There's DJ Khaled showing us. More importantly, what are the implications for American politics if that communication line goes dead? But first, the Fulton County District Attorney's sprawling election interference case just got a little more narrow. We're going to talk about that and what it means for Donald Trump with Melissa Redmond, former Fulton County Deputy District Attorney, coming up next.
When it comes to teaching kids and teens about money, practice makes perfect. That's where Greenlight comes in. With a debit card and money app of their own, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Parents send instant money transfers, create custom chores, and automate allowance, while kids track their spending, set savings goals, and practice money skills they can use today and for life. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
So, look, all I want to do is this. I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have, because we won the state.
I just want to find 11,780 votes, just enough to overturn the Georgia 2020 election results. That was the now notorious January 2021 phone call between President Donald Trump and Georgia's Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger. It is also a central part of the sprawling election conspiracy case brought by Fulton County District Attorney Fonnie Willis. But today, that case got a little less sprawling when Judge Scott McAfee dismissed six of its 41 counts, citing lack of detail. And one of those counts is the one that specifically calls out Trump and his chief of staff, Mark Meadows, for that January 2nd call to Brad Raffensperger. Now, this doesn't mean that Trump is out of the woods, legally speaking. 35 of those 41 criminal counts are very much intact. But all of this is happening as we await Judge McAfee's ruling on whether or not DA Willis will be disqualified from her own case. And the judge has said that he hopes to rule on that matter by Friday. MSNBC legal analyst Melissa Redmond joins me now. She's a former Fulton County deputy district attorney and a professor at the University of Georgia School of Law. Melissa, thank you so much for joining me tonight. I am really eager to get your professional opinion on whether these charges, these counts, seemed overly broad or lacking definition in your mind when they were first charged. Does McAfee's dismissal seem unusual to you?
Well, it is a bit unusual in that although special demurrals are filed very often in criminal cases, they are rarely granted. And so basically the defense has to show that the crime has not been alleged with enough specificity for them to be put on notice of what they have to defend against. And so for these six offenses, all of which involved solicitation of violation of the oath of office by a public official, there's not enough information in the oath for the state to allege how the particular conduct violated a particular term of the oath. So different public officials in Georgia have different oaths. So some are more specific than others. And it just so happened that the oath taken by the representatives and the senators in Georgia, as well as the governor and the secretary of state, is very broad. And it just alleges that you will support the constitution of the state and the state of Georgia, which means that of all of the terms and all of the clauses and articles in each of those constitutions, the state would have to show or put in the indictment which one of those asking for the electors, I guess, alternate slate of electors to be appointed or for these votes to be found, which one of those clauses that conduct violated such that these people were being asked to violate their terms of their oath of office. So it's a little specific.
Yeah. You know far more about this than me, but it just seems like upholding the state constitution would prevent election fraud, right? Asking someone to find the votes to overturn the results of the election seems like a violation, asking that person to violate their oath of office. But I am not a lawyer and I have not, I've never worked for the state of Georgia. So I understand that there are some legal underpinnings to all of that. I do wonder if you think, you know, D.A. Willis is tenacious, like few other people on the national stage. And I wonder if you think she's going to let these go in the name of keeping this case already delayed and waylaid to some degree on track, or whether she's going to fight McAfee on this and sort of take another turn at these charges.
I think it will depend on the evidence they have. And of course, we don't have a full copy of the discovery that's been provided to the defense, because that's some of the arguments that you can kind of tell from the discovery that's been provided and the evidence that the state intends to use how that oath was violated. So the defense is on notice, but they would have to actually allege that in the indictment. And whether she would be able to do that would govern her decision of whether to appeal Judge McAfee, who has indicated in his order that if she asked for a certificate of immediate review, he would be inclined to grant it. However, the thing about RICO that prosecutors love and defense attorneys hate is that you really don't need those counts for this indictment to stand, and for her to proceed on the exact same case without proving those substantive offenses. So I actually don't think she will appeal. I think she may just be willing to let those counts go and just move forward with the RICO and using that conduct as overt acts. And she still will be allowed to do that.
Yeah, the sort of substance and the power of that broader case remains very much intact. Trump is not out of legal hot water by any stretch of the imagination. But then there's the sort of looming question that we're supposed to get resolution to on Friday, which is, does DA Fani Willis stay on this case? Do you read anything? I know judges aren't supposed to be political. Everybody tells me that all the time. But it seems clear that politics is very much on the horizon here. And I wonder if you read anything into Judge McAfee's decision to sort of give a few points to Trump, if you will, on the dismissal of these counts, with the expectation that he may be handing a win to Fani Willis on Friday by allowing her to stay on the case. Do you see that? Is that me just wearing a tinfoil hat on all of this? Or could there be some legitimacy to that?
No, I don't think you can read anything at all into this, because if you think about how the case is playing out, all of the motions that have been filed, and they're kind of slowly working their way through hearing those motions. And this actually wasn't the only motion to dismiss. So there are other motions to dismiss various counts still pending that Judge McAfee still has to rule on. So it looks to me like he's just kind of methodically going through the case and the hearings that he's held, the supplemental briefs submitted by each party after the hearing, and issuing orders kind of as he gets to them. This particular motion was held, I want to say, a couple of weeks before the motion to disqualify. So it makes sense that he's kind of going through and issuing the orders as he gets to those motions. But I don't think we can tell one way or the other what that indicates as far as how he intends to rule on the motion to disqualify, other than I do believe that if he's willing to grant a certificate of immediate review for the special demurrers, that may indicate his willingness to have these issues resolved before the case goes to trial. So whichever way he rules on the motion to dismiss, perhaps he would also be willing to give either side a certificate of immediate review, which would further delay the case. So I think the only thing we can read is that it is very unlikely that this case is going to be tried this year.
Melissa Redmond, keeping me in line and giving us the hard truth about what is happening down in Fulton County. Thank you so much for your time and wisdom tonight. Really appreciate you.
Thank you.
We have more ahead this hour, including what Hungarian autocrat Viktor Orban says about Trump's plan to end the war in Ukraine. Here's a hint. Putin wins. But first, a rare moment of bipartisanship today in Congress could lead to the end of TikTok. Congressman Jamal Bowman joins me here on set to discuss the potential political fallout of that major decision. Stay with us.
Hey, parents. Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
If you haven't already heard, the U.S. government is trying to permanently shut down TikTok.
TikTok has gotten so desperate that they're sending out SOS messages on the app, begging people to call their U.S. Congress representatives.
Hi, I'm calling to ask about the TikTok ban.
Hi, I'm calling about the TikTok ban.
Vote no on the TikTok ban, HR 7521.
HR 7521.
Call your representative. Tell them to vote no, and if they don't, you're going to vote them out in the primaries.
Last week, the social media app TikTok urged its 170 million American users to call their representatives in Congress. By noon the same day, the phone lines for members of the House, members of Congress, were overwhelmed with calls, mostly from teenagers. Some congressional aides said their offices received hundreds of calls in a matter of hours. But despite, or maybe because of, how much TikTok clearly matters to young Americans, today the House overwhelmingly passed the bill that all of these TikTok users urged their representatives not to pass, HR 7521. I should say that despite how TikTok framed the bill to its users, this is not an immediate TikTok ban. The way this bill is written, TikTok's Chinese parent company, ByteDance, has 6 months to sell the company to a buyer approved by the U.S. government, or it will be banned from app stores and therefore gone. But before we even get to that 6 month countdown, the bill still has to pass the Senate. And then it has to be signed into law by President Biden. And the politics involved in passing those hurdles are not exactly straightforward. This bill has made a lot of very weird bedfellows. You have Democrats like Maxwell Frost lined up against the bill with the likes of Marjorie Taylor Greene and Matt Gaetz. They all have freedom of speech issues with the bill, although definitely not the same freedom of speech issues. And the proponents of the bill are also a rather unusual group. Speaker Emerita Nancy Pelosi, for example, is working with far-right rabble-rouser Chip Roy. They are united by concerns that the Chinese government may be using TikTok as a vehicle to meddle in American politics. And as with the rest of our politics, the whole thing's made even more complicated and messy by Donald Trump. Back when Trump was president, he tried to ban TikTok via executive order. But now Trump has reversed course completely and come out in favor of TikTok. So it's all fairly indecipherable. But if there's one thing that everyone on all sides of this issue can agree on here, it is that TikTok matters. If you don't use TikTok, it could be easy to write the app off as just the place where young people teach each other Beyonce dances and make jokes that boomers don't get. But the app is actually kind of a modern public square. It is filled with content like this about news and politics.
Hey, everyone. This is Bissam from Gaza. I'm still alive.
These dark red states, abortion's already outlawed there.
As a registered Democrat, no, I'm not voting for Joe Biden. Sorry, not sorry.
Want to know a great reason to vote for Joe Biden in 2024? The Supreme Court.
Today, I'll be ranking my top 10 reasons on why Joe Biden truly sucks.
How is the best case scenario, Joe Biden?
Like it or not, TikTok is currently what is energizing young voters. American teens spend an average of an hour and a half on TikTok every day. And poll after poll has shown that TikTok may be the top news source for Gen Z Americans. And it really is worth emphasizing just how significant it is that the app got a sizable chunk of America's Gen Z population to pick up a phone and call a stranger in Congress. I am not trying to malign America's youth here, but statistically speaking, phone calls are not their thing. They do not like phone calls. So yes, today's vote in the House was about the future of TikTok, but in that, it was also about the future of our political landscape. And in the immediate future, it is about getting out the vote for the November election. We are going to talk about all of that and more with Representative Jamal Bowman right after the break. Back in 2020, then-President Donald Trump tried to ban TikTok via executive order, which the courts quickly told him he could not do. But in the last week, Donald Trump has done a 180.
There are a lot of people on TikTok that love it. There are a lot of young kids on TikTok who will go crazy without it. There are a lot of users. There's, you know, a lot of good.
A lot of good. Why the change of heart, Donald Trump? Two reasons. The first appears to be cash. Trump recently hosted Jeff Yass at his Mar-a-Lago club in Florida. Yass is a billionaire investor in ByteDance, which is the parent company of TikTok, and Trump is seeking his support in the presidential race. Maybe don't upset the billionaire TikTok investor if you want his money. The second reason is voters. Trump ally Kellyanne Conway has been advocating for TikTok on behalf of the Club for Growth. That's the conservative organization where, it so happens, billionaire Jeff Yass puts a lot of his money. And Ms. Conway lobbied Trump by arguing that his supporters, especially the younger ones, like TikTok.
Here are three reasons why, if you're a young person like me, you should vote for Trump.
We like Trump because he actually stood up to you and also exposed you. You want socialism. We don't.
Please, 4 more years. Please, 4 more years.
Trump.
Please, 4 more years. Please, 4 more years.
But Donald Trump and his party are not the only ones defending TikTok. Some House Democrats voted against the ban today. And while they may not share Donald Trump's reasons or motivations, they too think banning TikTok is a very bad idea. Joining me now is one of those House Democrats, Congressman Jamal Bowman of New York. Congressman Bowman, thank you for being here.
Good to be with you.
I'm sorry that you had to witness some of those TikTok videos. I apologize to our viewers at home as well. But first, tell me why you voted against the TikTok ban.
Well, once again, Congress is trying to shove a bill down our throats within just a few days. Oh, we're going to ban TikTok. You got to vote for it right now. Let's hurry up and get this done. So first of all, it's moving too quickly. Secondly, trying to get ByteDance to sell within 160 days or 180 days is unreasonable, completely unreasonable. Third, free speech. You know, there are people who use TikTok to, you know, they have small businesses on TikTok. They use it to build community. So it's a free speech issue. And fourth, when are we going to have a comprehensive conversation about all of social media and all of the problems on social media, including our data being sold on the open market to China and other nations without our consent, without our knowledge? So we need to talk about privacy. We need to talk about mental health. We need to talk about all of social media. Why do we continue to scapegoat TikTok, especially when I haven't seen any evidence or not enough evidence to tell me that it's a national security issue? And so that's why I voted no on the bill.
I do want to talk about the sort of the social media aspect, the user realities, the political implications of taking away the platform that hundreds of millions of people, 170 million Americans, the youngs are all over it. And it is the primary
channel.
It's
like half the country.
Yeah. I mean, it's the primary channel for communication with America's youth. As a Democrat and someone who seeks re-election, as someone who's heading into a big election year, what do you think the implications of just basically taking down TikTok?
You know, it doesn't make sense to me. Young voters already feel disenfranchised because we do a horrible job of reaching out to young voters, connecting with them, engaging them, and listening to them. TikTok is actually a platform where young voters have found community with each other, and they're learning a lot more about politics. They're learning more about their elected officials, votes their elected officials have taken, what we all stand for, and they're sharing information, whether it's related to foreign policy, domestic policy, childcare, education, whatever the issues are. So they are literally building their own community and building their own political power. Why are we then going to disenfranchise them even further, especially when young voters have a tendency to vote Democrat if we go about engaging them and doing it the right way? So having this discussion and trying to ban it or almost ban it makes no sense at this time.
Yeah, I mean, we look at the numbers of, you know, the latest polling, the head-to-head matchups between Donald Trump and Joe Biden. Young voters under 35, Biden leads 52-48. That's a 4-point lead. The margin of error is 3 points. We are talking about young people here. This is a group that has recently been overwhelmingly in support of the Democratic Party and its platforms. That's probably for Democrats, an uncomfortably narrow margin. And then you talk about the Democratic support in communities of color among Black voters, Hispanic voters, Latino voters, many of whom are not going to traditional media for their news and information. That's a staggering, staggering curve downwards. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, you know, how essential platforms, including social media, are going to be in this election to bringing those folks back in the fold and telling the story of a Democrats in the White House.
And I think that's why you saw such a diverse representation of who voted no on this bill. It wasn't just the squad. It was moderate and more conservative Democrats. I mean, we had the ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee vote no on this particular bill. So you have these diverse responses to this because we understand the implications politically, socially, and in terms of our entire country. And so we need young voters. We need young voters of color. We need to engage them as much as possible. We need to not disenfranchise them. And we need to respect their voices and how they're engaging. They're all over social media. They're not watching MSNBC as much as we would like them to.
But
they're welcome to, but they're not. They're on social media. They're on TikTok. How are we using TikTok to engage them? And listen, let me just say this one other thing. Our biggest issue when it comes to national security is ourselves. We hurt ourselves more because we ignore the needs of the American people. You push through a TikTok ban, but you're not doing nothing on foreign policy aid. Well, not enough. You're not doing nothing on affordable housing. You're not doing enough on childcare. You're not doing nothing on the issues that Americans care about quickly. We can never turn the corner on those issues.
Let me ask you, you said that you've not been given any hard evidence or sufficient evidence that this is a real national security threat. Any more than any other social media is a national security threat. Do you at all worry, though, about the memification of American politics, that that's what we're sort of acquiescing to, that it's like anybody can put up their content and hopefully the truthful stuff rises to the top and goes most viral. But, you know, it's a better's game.
Yes, I am. TikTok is way better at that than Twitter, than Facebook, and then some of the other platforms. So I am worried about the bite size, memification, headline nature of how social media operates. But what I've seen on TikTok is the depth of content and the depth of scholarship exists there that I haven't seen on the other platforms. Twitter right now is a cesspool. I mean, you go on there, you send out a tweet. Next thing you know, you have the far right white nationalists attacking you for all kinds of nonsense and lies and disinformation, misinformation live on that platform and Facebook. Facebook also, and I've been told this, China uses Facebook to get more of our data than anywhere else by far. But we're not talking about banning Facebook. And Facebook was implicated in what Russia did in 2016. So what are we talking about?
Well, obviously there needs to be a broader and more transparent conversation. And in the meantime, enjoy learning the steps to the Beyonce video, Texas Hold'em, because it's all over TikTok. And that's how I spent part of my time preparing for the show. Congressman Jamal Bowman, thank you so much for your time and thoughts.
You.
Really
to
great
see
to
you.
Have you here.
Of course.
Still ahead this evening, Trump's strongman obsession reaches a new low. We are going to get into the very real fallout from the Trump-Orban-Putin triumvirate with former Obama advisor Ben Rhodes coming up next. Russian President Vladimir Putin is days away from another election that is expected to keep him in power for another 6 years. And that is happening as Ukraine loses ground in its war with Russia because of ammunition shortages, while the U.S. Congress continues to do nothing. Two dueling attempts to force a vote on Ukraine aid are making their way through Congress right now, but neither has a strong chance of leading to an actual vote. And according to Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban, who just met with Donald Trump last week, the presumptive Republican presidential nominee told Orban he will not give a penny to help Ukraine. Orban concluded, therefore, the war will end because it is obvious that Ukraine cannot stand on its own feet. Joining me now is Ben Rhodes, former Deputy National Security Advisor for the Obama White House. Ben, thanks for being here with me this evening. There was a lot of consternation leading up to this Orban-Trump meeting that Orban would basically be an interlocutor for Putin. And it feels like that's exactly what happened. How do you see the sort of fallout from that meeting last week?
Yeah, look, it's not subtle at all, Alex. Yeah. And, I mean, I don't usually plug things, but I wrote a book a couple years ago that is about this phenomenon of Trump, Orban, and Putin and what they share in common, which is both a sense of their own domestic politics and the kind of leaders they want to be at home, and therefore the kind of world that they want to live in. Putin is at the far end of the authoritarian spectrum. He's already transitioned his country from something that was trying to be a democracy to essentially a one-man, one-rule dictatorship. Orban is on that spectrum. He's in the middle. He's kind of turned this country that was a liberal democracy into kind of a soft autocracy where there's really one-party rule. Trump wants to be these guys. But the price of that is kind of signing on to this no holds barred, no respect for sovereignty, no care for democracy, foreign policy of Putin's. Putin is at the vanguard of this clique of authoritarians, this kind of triangle of sadness, if you will, between these three guys. And it was pretty clear to me that Orban's been talking to Putin, and he walks out of the meeting in Mar-a-Lago with what he wanted, which is a commitment from Donald Trump to throw Ukraine under the bus and join the autocrats club if the election goes his way in November.
You know, I was thinking, we had a conversation with Jacob Heilbrunn last week, who made, I think, the very important point that in terms of historic parallels, in and around World War II, there was a whole faction of Americans who were, quote unquote, isolationists. And he made the point that isolationism is often a misnomer because it veils fascism. And that a lot of the people who were against the U.S. entry into World War II were actually pro-Hitler. They were pro-Nazi. I wonder if you think the same is true in the modern day, whether the resistance to aid in Ukraine actually betrays a proto or pro-fascist attitude inside the Republican Party.
There's no question in my mind that does, Alex. I mean, Viktor Orban has been transparent. He's declared that he's the vanguard of so-called illiberal democracy, is what he calls it, which is essentially a contradiction in terms. He has embraced the reality that he's a far-right nationalist who demonizes the other, be it immigrants or be it liberal elites or whoever is in his firing line in that given day. And he's used his power to essentially silence critics and ensure that his party remains in power. He has essentially a Mussolini agenda. This, you know, Trump inviting this guy to Mar-a-Lago is the same thing as if you'd invited Mussolini for a weekend getaway in the 1930s here. And let's be clear, not giving Ukraine aid is a choice. Right. I mean, you can call it isolationism, but it is a choice to cut these people off and allow Vladimir Putin to run roughshod over them when that serves no other interest other than the kind of continued momentum behind this kind of strongman autocracy in the world, which the Republican Party seems to hold in such high esteem now. And so we have to recognize it's a choice to cut the cord on Ukraine in this manner. And what it's going to do is put wind in the sails of not just Putin, but this kind of brand of autocracy that we see gaining traction in lots of parts of the world.
Yeah. I mean, if you're a would-be autocrat and you're looking at the weekend plans around the world, Putin's going to win in a sham election another 6 years in office. Ukraine is, as we said, ammunition shortages on the battlefield. The war there is looking bleaker and bleaker for the forces of democracy. You know, it is a dark horizon that we're gazing out against. And yet, you know, people in Washington seem to be largely content to do nothing about it. The fact that it's unlikely for Democrats to get a basic, simple majority on a discharge petition to fund this is staggering.
Yeah. And let's not forget, Alex, the guy that appeared with Putin in billboards for his reelection campaign was also Bibi Netanyahu, who would like to be a part of this club as well. The reality is, if you talk to people around the world, talk to people in Europe, they're astonished and panicked and anxiety ridden about the fact that the money that is going to be spent to purchase these weapons for Ukraine is spent in the United States. It is money for our defense industrial base. We send the money to U.S. states to build the kind of shells and ammunition that is needed by the Ukrainians and ship it over there. So we're essentially cutting the Ukrainians loose and cutting the cord on funding that actually supports U.S. jobs and industry, albeit in the defense industry, of course. For what? So that we can align ourselves with Putin. And so not only does that have the U.S. retreating from its role in the world and standing up for democracies like Ukraine that are under threat, it also is, again, signaling a choice. The United States is moving into this other column here, the Putin column. So it's not just isolationism. It's making, again, a choice about which side we're on in this continued balance and struggle between democracy and autocracy. That has people around the world much more exercised than kind of in Washington, where it seems like, oh, this is just another political game. It's like another government shutdown or another fight over the debt ceiling. No, if we don't deliver this money to Ukraine, they will lose territory. They will lose people. They will lose momentum on the front line of the biggest war in Europe since World War II. And our politics just can't seem to process that.
Yeah, it's a real statement of priorities on behalf of the United States of America. Ben Rhodes, my friend, thank you so much for your time and thoughts tonight. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Alex.
That is our show for the evening.
When it comes to teaching kids and teens about money, practice makes perfect. That's where Greenlight comes in. With a debit card and money app of their own, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Parents send instant money transfers, create custom chores, and automate allowance, while kids track their spending, set savings goals, and practice money skills they can use today and for life. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.